Hi, y'all. My name is Katie Parker, and I am an alcoholic. I've had the gift of sobriety since October the 28th of 1984, and that is 5 months longer than Charlie Parker. And it will always be 5 months longer than Charlie Parker. God, I love that. Oh my gosh, you guys. Bob, this is such an honor. It's such an honor to be asked to speak at Stateline. Now, I know anything you do in Alcoholics Anonymous is an honor, but this beats setting up tables and chairs, okay? Hands down. At my home group, we do that. We make the coffee, we set up tables and chairs, and I am humbled. But to be asked to speak here, when you hear what's going on in the third step for me and my story, you'll understand that 10 years ago, this wouldn't be the girl you'd want behind this podium. And I've heard a lot of the other speakers. Ron did a fabulous job. Mildred did a spectacular job. And they set me up nicely for the third step. But I have to say that sitting in this room with a lot of people I know and a tremendous amount of my heroes in AA, and I have heroes in AA. I have no problem saying that at all. There are people that I watch in AA, and I want to be like them. And I believe God puts those people in your life. Bob Darrell happens to be one of them. I'm going to try so hard not to cry all the way through this. Bob Darrell happens to be one, and Mark Houston was one. And those people took my life down a path that has me standing here today. And so I get to share that experience with you, and I can't wait to see how well it goes. Besides the fact, don't I look good on that screen? Thank you. I know. When you've been sober 26 years and you start young, I got sober at 26 years old, and you quit putting poison in your body, you're going to probably look pretty good. So I got sober 26 years old, and I have a 31-year-old daughter. I had her when I was 21, and I have a 21-year-old son, and I have a 4-year-old grandson, which I believe is God's total do-over for any of you drunks that have grandchildren, and you really, really did a poor job at raising your own children. You get the opportunity to just spoil them rotten. And one of the things, Max, he's so funny, he'll say, "Graham, can I have a popsicle before dinner?" I'm like, "Have 10. I am no longer the disciplinary. Have anything you want, man. Oh, it is the best. Oh, I could go into story after story after story, but I'm excited to speak on the third step, you guys, because I'm passionate about the third step. One of the main reasons is because I missed it. I missed it for a long, 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 long time. And I believe that I'm not the only one in the room that's missed the third step. I love what Mildred said. At 20 years, she had the bottom fell out. Most everybody has some sort of story that in longer-term sobriety, their life fell apart. And I really, really believe it all stems from the third step, or at least that's been my experience. So I hope to be able to get you all of this in this period of time. Lee and I are working together to know where my time is, but I'm usually pretty good at it. Charlie, on the other hand, is not good at his time. So I'm always trying to help him out there. I'm like, but oh well. Okay, so I am third born in the 50s. Oh, Ron, I loved all of your Perry Mason and oh my gosh, you know, you younger generation just don't know what you missed when you only had 3 channels, man. Life was great, you know. And you had 3 channels. You had your bicycle that had no seat on it, and you just rode it down the road with that pipe sticking straight up. You know, your buddy on the front, your buddy on the back, no pads, no helmet, no nothing. It's good. But I was the baby of the 50s. I was born in the 50s. I was a baby of three, my brother, my sister, and myself. We were all 2 years apart. That's just what you did. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. My dad was, my dad was a NFL football player, only 1 year, but That was big news in our house. And early on, I knew, you know, you hear most speakers always say they never felt like they fit in. And I never knew that's what I was feeling. But I always felt like everybody teased me. Katie was the pain in the neck. Oh, here comes Katie. Katie's crying. This is going on, you know. And I blamed a lot on that about being third born. But today I realized that I'm clearly alcoholic. My brother's clearly alcoholic who has not found this program. And my sister's an untreated Al-Anon. My father was probably alcoholic. And so when I'm 9 years old, I'm in the second grade. I'm actually eight going to turn in nine. My mother dies very unexpectedly. And back in the 60s, it was 1966, you didn't do the grieving. You didn't do the balloons. You didn't put their name on a balloon and send it up to God. And you didn't do anything. As a matter of fact, people told me that God took my mother and because they needed her in heaven. So, you know, I immediately went, well, I don't care much for this dude at all, right? And so my mom was my ally. My dad clearly liked my sister more than me. These are all my observations that I've made. Now, here's the tricky thing. My mother dies, and my dad remarries 6 weeks later. I know it. You know, nobody ever wants to talk about that in the family, but that was bizarre. She lasted a weekend. That was it. She's in, she's out. And a lot of booze flowed at our house. You know, my dad's an ex-NFL football player. Come on, man. We party. Alcohol was fun, right? And so I was raised on alcohol being fun. It was party at my house. And so 3 months later, he marries again. And she lasts a little bit longer, about a month and a half. And then he remarries again. So he married three times in 18 months. And we had four live-in housekeepers. I can't ever remember if it's four or six, but I believe it was four live-in housekeepers. And because he was a traveling salesman for Union Carbide, he was an electrician or engineer or something. I never really got that. But, you know, because it really is about me. So my dad did something. He made a living. Let's put it that way. You know, I don't really know what he did. And you'll clearly see where all that comes out later. But what that did in my life is it influenced my old ideas. Didn't make me alcoholic. Now, I'd have told you when I came into AA, you would have drank too if you had to live in that household. You know, my mother died. Tragedy. We alcoholics love tragedy. We'll drag that little bag around forever. And so, but it did influence my old ideas. Now, I don't know all this, right? Once again, all the speakers have said, looking back, that's what we find out. Well, back in the 60s, you could really get passed through school if you were well-liked. And I was very well-liked. As a matter of fact, I was, you know, I was the favorite every year in high school. I was the Brazoria County Fair Queen candidate. I was the Duchess for the homecoming. I mean, I learned real quick that it was way better to have people like you than to be that silent little kid standing in the corner, the invisible personality. And I just happened to have that personality. My dad had that personality. So from the second grade to the fifth grade, the teachers just passed me on because my mother had died. And it was the news at school. You know, Katie's mother died. You know, it's tough at their house. Just pass her through. And so by the time I got to the fifth grade, I realized I knew nothing. I mean, I could read, but I couldn't comprehend. I couldn't spell. And I became a professional cheater from the fifth grade on. And I don't use that term lightly. I mean, I was breaking into the school. I was leaving the window unlocked. I was creative. And back then, all you needed was a number two pencil, right? Yeah, see, once again, you younger generation just don't know what you're missing, man. You could go far in life with a number two pencil. And so I'm breaking into the school. I'm stealing the test out of the teacher's briefcase. I mean, I'm good. And I'm driven. Now, I didn't get that. Once again, I don't get any of this stuff. But I am a driven kid. My dad can no longer take care of me. He's absolutely out of his mind with the level of Katie and her lying, Katie and her self-centeredness. Now, at the time, I don't know that's all going on, but I am so self-consumed with my life that my dad and I have this big blow-up. The last stepmother that he married, the last woman he married, remained my stepmother and is still my stepmother today. My dad's passed away. But I told my dad I can't live with these rules, you know, that level of entitlement that we alcoholics have. And I left home at 15. And I left home at 15 with the clear understanding that I was going to get my diploma. Because, see, if I don't get my diploma, I'm a loser. I could have cared less about the education. Actually, today I could still care less about the education if you really want to know the truth. Education is not my cup of tea. But if it's your cup of tea, it's important to you. But it's just not important to me. I've been sober 26 years. I'm 52 years old, and I really don't care where Venezuela is. I just don't. You know, we flew into Minneapolis a few weeks ago, and I told Charlie, I said, I remember when I was about 43 flying in here looking out the window thinking, I did not know they were on the ocean. Yeah. I just don't care. We had a kid come to our group, our home group, and I sponsor little Gail. And, we call each other dumb and dumber. And this kid's from Norway. He said, you know, he's from Norwegia. And I said, silly, he is Norwanian. And I mean, people stand around us are like, who are these two? It's like, whatever. But by God, I got. And I'm a successful businesswoman. I've been self-employed for 30 years. I'm top producer in my company. I mean, I am not stupid. But I also knew that an education didn't have to, it wasn't what I needed to fulfill me. But I got to tell you guys, especially if you're a teacher, you can't stand to hear what I'm saying. You're like, no, she's still missing it. She doesn't understand. Oh, yes, I do. I am married to a very smart, book smart man who's insistent on teaching me where the Nile River is. And let's go to another museum. And I'm like, oh. I don't care. I'm like the kid walking through the museum like this. Oh. Oh my God. We went to do some stupid Texas history. And he's over there at the Alamo, you know, with the tear in his eye when the guy's drawing the line in the sand. And I'm like, oh my God, how much longer is this? Oh, I'm telling you. So, I think I've made it clear that I don't care for me, for the whole learning thing. So I you know, I'm trying to make my way in life. I convinced this woman at 15 years old, I got to get through high school. I take summer school. Oh my God, can you cheat in summer school? Oh, I had no idea. I'd have done my whole high school as summer school if I'd have known you could cheat so easy. And so I'm doing summer school. I graduate early. I mean, I am driven as a kid. I got to make a living, so I go knocking on doors. I love what Mildred said. You used to be able to knock on doors. It was a different day and time. You knock on doors. I said, listen, I need to make a little bit of money. Is there anything you need? Yard work, whatever, wash and wax your car. I did all these things because I knew I can survive, man. I can survive anything. And you'll see this throughout my story. The principal called me in his office, and I'll never forget him saying, you know, why are you, by this time I'm 16 now, and he says, why is your car over on 2nd Street? You know, I'd convinced this woman to let me rent a house from her for $62.50, and I had to pay her every 2 weeks because I was afraid I couldn't save the money, and I do still have a serious money problem, but that's a whole other issue. And so I said, well, Mr. Phillips, I'm living in that house. I just ended up leaving home, blah, blah, blah. And once again, he said, you know, Katie, I'll tell you what, you get through school and we won't look at this. I loved life back then. It just didn't have nearly as much whatever rules about, you know, legally, and you can't do this to a kid. You can swat the crap out of a kid. I'm all for that, man. So, and you'll understand why here shortly. Well, then I end up, I leave that area as quickly as I can. It was outside of Houston, South Texas, and I leave that area. I get up to Austin as fast as I possibly can because I love Austin, Texas. That's where I'm from. And I have a baby. I'm 21 years old. She was born 2 weeks after my 21st birthday. And let me tell you what. Let me back up a bit. I started drinking at 12. Oh, my gosh, you guys. The minute I drank, I knew booze did for me. It really did for me what nothing else did. Living in that household, my mother died, my allied was gone. I mean, I did a tremendous amount of outside issues, don't get me wrong, but I absolutely loved booze. And now, of course, I didn't drink booze from that day on since I was 12. The outside issues were a whole lot easier to get a hold of. As a matter of fact, you always had to wait in front of the 7-Eleven. How many of you guys know that one? Yeah, when you're 14 years old and you got to wait for that creepy guy to pull up. You know, and you see a creepy man, and you know that guy will buy us booze, and you get him to go in there and buy you booze, and then you got to lose creepy guy because, you know, creepy guy wants to come with you, and I love the way we laugh, but creepy guy's sitting out there right here right now, yeah, you know who creepy guy is. And I'm telling you what, we were quick. You had to get rid of creepy guy because creepy guy would sleep with the 14-year-old girl, you know. It's like, you know, flicking a booger off your finger, man. You were like, okay, I'm gonna go through the woods on my bike, and we got the booze that we needed, the wine, and we just had a ball. We just had a ball. Man, alcohol was great. I was the one that everybody looked towards. It's like, okay, Katie's bringing the booze. I was just the booze girl. And alcohol worked for a long time until you have babies. Well, we got a little problem there. When you have babies, babies like to get up in the morning. That's a problem. And they like to eat. That's a whole nother problem. Because I am well hungover, and that does not work in my schedule. And the wheels fell off. Well, I'm going to fast forward here because I got into Alcoholics Anonymous because the wheels fell off, and life was, this kid was way too difficult. And I could go into 20 stories about, all the things that happened between April and I, and it was just, it's horrific. And incomprehensible demoralization, I know well. I was a single mother dragging this kid around. It was heartbreaking. And I also know the fact that I couldn't stop drinking, and that was very, very scary. So I get into Alcoholics Anonymous at 26 years old. This little girl now is 5. And when I came into AA, I will never forget my first meeting. This girl takes me out of the meeting, and she's explaining alcoholism to me. Now, it's pretty fuzzy, but she basically said, because I told her, I said, I have no problem with alcohol. It's the outside issues, man. They're killing me. I'm staying up too late. It's terrible. But the booze, I got no problem with booze. And she gave me the whole deal about, the whole alcoholism. What do you call it when you kind of qualify someone? She gave me the whole rundown, and I failed the test miserably. And so she ended up, I realized that I had a problem with booze and that I couldn't do either one of them. But I'll tell you, when I came into that meeting, I loved the laughter. God, I loved the laughter. I hadn't laughed in a long, long time. And everybody in that room was just, they were so, they were happy. They were young. They weren't the guy in the trench coat. You know how we are. We thought, I mean, how many of you guys thought you were going to come into AA and they were all the homeless guys? Absolutely. I think people still believe that today. And it wasn't at all that. As a matter of fact, there was a couple of people I drank with that were sitting in there. I had no idea. So I kind of go with this delusion that booze is the problem. Because, see, booze worked great for about 5 years. And then the wheels fell off, man. And if you understood it the way I understood it, my problem was booze. And then, somebody says, you can't do it, God can. And what do? They throw me down on my knees and we do the third step prayer. And that's, I got sober 26 years ago, guys. You may have had it different, but what I had was the inner child and codependency recovery. That was happening back then, happening. And doesn't that sound like way more fun than those hinky 12 steps? Yeah, because I got to always talk about me. Let's go to a counselor and talk about me. And my family of origin. Mm-hmm. And so I remember doing the third step prayer with this guy thinking, oh, my God, this is the hokiest thing I have ever seen. And who puts the word bondage in a prayer? I mean, I am like 12 days sober thinking, I know what bondage is, and I want nothing to do with bondage and God, okay? Woo! And so, that was my experience, I completely misunderstood self-will, and not God's will, self-will and willpower. Because, see, I'm just like Mildred. Oh, man, I got it from here. Thank you very much. And that was what I did. When I got sober, it was like a relay race. I'd be running the show, because the problem's booze. Now, I don't know that. I'm running the show, and I'm like going, oh, man, God, we need to pull you in on this one. It's not going well, and I'd hand him the baton. And then all of a sudden, it was like he moves like this. And I'm like, give it back, dude, boy, jeez Louise, I can get, ooh, I'm back on, you know, because God just works way too slow for me, way too slow. And I got problems, I got big problems to solve. And if I need him again, I'll pull him in, and I'll go through the motions, but I got this deal. So here's what happens, this is it in a nutshell. I get married, I'm in AA, I fall in love with this man, he's got 6 years. Because, you know, he's going to fix me, and that's what we need. We need the guy to fix us. Most women do, which leads me to one quick statement I want to say. There are a lot of strong women in Alcoholics Anonymous. Some silly old idea there. There are a lot of strong women in Alcoholics Anonymous, and yes, women are scared of other women because out there in the world of drinking, they are the competition, right? But when they come into this room, you boys take them by the hand and take them to the women. Say yes. Doggone it. Because they're going to come to you first. And don't buy into it. Silly, silly men. Okay, that was my one plug for us girls. I think it kind of fell flat, but we'll see. So, I get married. I'm doing tons of therapy, guys. I mean tons. I am in group therapy for 3 years. Then I take a break, and I do another 6 years, all on family of origin, codependency. And family of origin, codependency, and inner child. And let me tell you, I am well-versed. I could actually run a group right now. If anybody's interested afterwards, we'll just sit around and we'll talk about that stuff. But what ended up happening that I didn't understand, now keep in mind, you can get pretty well with some outside therapy. I'm not against outside therapy. But what happened is I built this whole life of self around it. I damaged a relationship with my father, and unfortunately he passed away before I had my next spiritual awakening at 17 years. Where I had kept a distance from my dad because I needed those boundaries. When did not loving a family member and staying away from a family member ever become acceptable in Alcoholics Anonymous? Our book says we must take the lead, right? And so I do all this therapy. I have another child. I ran the entire family. Oh, my gosh. Can you tell by my personality? My husband and I were the yin and yang. I mean, he was just like, he finally said, whatever. Drive. Fine, drive. You pay the bills. Fine, pay the bills. I mean, I could bring home the bacon, fry it up in the pan, and never, never let you forget you're a man. Oh, yeah. I'm telling you. What do you need? You need something? That's me. Come on, ask me. People would say, I wish you'd go talk to my family. I'm on it. I'll go talk to them. What do you need? Huh? Your brother bothering you? I'll go talk to your brother. Yeah. I had all the confidence in the world that I could run your life. Just let me. Oh my God, you guys. It was so insane. I look back at it now. I have made more amends in sobriety than I ever made drinking. Because I ran over everybody's life sober. That's sad, isn't it? Those are the ones where, you know, I'd come back to people when I was drinking, and I made some pretty weak amends, don't get me wrong. My ninth step was very, very weak. But when you're drinking, you're kind of like proud of yourself in those amends. You know, I'm not really proud of my behavior, but I was drinking. You go back and make amends stone cold sober at 10 years when you're running your life on self-will, I can't stop crying. I'm just absolutely humiliated and ashamed of my behavior, of what I did to people in the business world, what I did to family members. When my father passed away, I told my stepbrother, he said, we need to go ahead and start at such and such a time. And I said, you're not even our blood. You got no say-so in this at all. Delightful. 10 years sober. Mm-hmm. Yep. That was me. Oh, and I'm sure there was a bunch of FUs lobbed out in the middle of it, because we can get so white trash in my family sometimes. My last name was Oster Miller. We called ourselves the Oster Yellers. Whoever yelled the loudest won. And we didn't care who was around, right? So I'm over here running the show, and I'll tell you what, life got better. I was 15th in my company out of 5,000. I was a top producer. They wanted me to go speak around the world telling people how I did it. You know, I traveled the world for 18 years, first class. Life was good. Now, I have been completely living a life based on the abstinence of alcohol. Now, I don't know that. No, you won't know that until the wheels fall off. And I love the line in the third step where it says, I became the victim of the delusion that I could wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if I just managed well. There is a lot in that line. A victim in the 1935 dictionary means duped or tricked. So I'm tricked by my own delusion that I can get you to do what I need you to do to get what I want. I mean, how many of you guys ever put your kids in the back seat of the car and said, by God, we're going to have fun. Sit down. Sit down. We are going on our way to a family vacation. Get in that car. God Almighty. I swear to God, I had that whole exorcist thing down like crazy. I mean, my kids, Oh my God, my son, if you're a woman and you're raising boys, and I swear, Linda, my heart always, every time I think of that, I think of the Bazans. You got to come in there and be the alpha figure, right? I'd come in the house and Sam's be telling his buddies, man, get your feet off the table. She'll kill you. She'll kill both of us, you know? And I'd walk in, I'd go, hey, you know? And the kid move his feet and Sam goes, I told you, dude, told you. She crazy. And I won't even go to the whole time when I lost the cat and I put a cat on me that had died and I'm laying there crying and the cat gets into rigor mortis and is stiff on me. My son walks in with his buddy. I go, you want to pet Mo? And he's like, oh my God, hundreds and hundreds of those stories. To me, that life seemed normal. Oh my God, I still don't even know the kid and I don't want to know the kid because I just want to, I don't want those thoughts, right? So Joe and I buy a house, right? We buy this house. Now that is so big for the alcoholic, yes. You know that you get to buy a home. If you didn't lose a home and you get to buy a home, oh, it's such a big deal. And so it was in the 1986 when the bottom fell out in Texas and everything's under foreclosure and we get this realtor this realtor says, there's five people bidding on this house, guys. I don't know if you're going to get it. Well, see, I'm driven. I got to know that we got it. And if I didn't get it, I got to make it happen. And so I tell Joe, the bidding's happening in San Antonio, 70 miles away. I said, Joe, let's go down there and find out. He goes, we don't even know where we're going. I go, doesn't matter. Get in the car. Well, I had so much power over my husband. God love him. And he gets in the car. Because he does whatever I ask him to do, right? And I don't mean that in the whole whipped thing. You got that, boys? I don't mean that whole whipped thing. It just wasn't worth the fight, right? How many of y'all know that? It just wasn't worth the fight. And you know what? Katie can probably get us the house. So I think I'll get in the car. That's more how the deal went. And so we get in the car, we're driving down there, and he goes, how are we going to find this place? I don't know, but I'll find it. I got it from here. We pull up to a gas station in San Antonio. There's a man getting gas in his car. I said, excuse me, sir, if they're doing foreclosures in this, for the state of Texas, can you tell me where they'd be? And the man happened to know. Tell me that's not God's will. Oh, absolutely. It's always God's will when it works my way. Always God's will. And I get in the car and I still get Joe and Charlie all mixed up, but he loved my husband, so he's good with that. I get in the car and I tell Joe, I go, oh my God, this is so God's will. So we drive to this state building and we get out and we get in there and it's almost like the New York Stock Exchange. I've never seen anything like it. People are yelling out numbers and all of this is going on and it means nothing to us. Now I'm standing there going, great. Now I don't know where to go from here. And so, you know me, I'm looking around and I see these three women in an office behind a computer and I'm like, Joe, give me a minute. He said. So I go in this room and this woman's sitting and she's like, oh, I can't look in my computer and do whatever. And I'm like, yes, you can. Get into my vortex. give me a few minutes with you. Give me a few minutes with you. And then she's like, and she looks at me and she goes, is your name Katie Gordon? I said, yes, ma'am, it is. She goes, you own the home. Yes! I walk out, I'm looking at Joe. It's ours, baby. It is ours. I could not wait 6 hours. See, I'm driven. When you are living a life based on the abstinence of alcohol and miss the third step, I wasn't choosing to act that way. I had to act that way. See, I can't sit 6 hours in my own skin. I don't know what that's like. I got to go find out if that house is mine or not. Man, I look back at that stuff, it's insane. Well, let me fast forward now. My husband gets very, very sick. We do not know what's wrong with him, but he is acting strangely. He's at a psychiatrist. He's got a history of depression, clinical depression. His mother had mental illness. I mean, it's a kind of the whole family deal there, and we don't know what's wrong. And this doctor says this psychiatrist said, I think it's organic. Now, I don't know how many of y'all in the room even know what that term means, but I'm like, what the hell is organic? And he goes, I think something's growing in his brain. And I go, growing in his brain? Well, what do you want us to do? And he goes, I want you to go down and get some testing. Okay. Well, how much is this testing going to cost? He's self-employed. I'm self-employed. We have catastrophic insurance. They don't cover testing. So I'm sitting in an AA meeting, and God's will, it's getting ready to happen again. And this girl says, I'm freaking out in the meeting, right? I'm at the sickest AA meeting you can go to, and there's plenty of sick ones out there. I'll be the first to say it. I was a member of the sickest AA meeting in Austin, Texas, and damn proud of it. Matter of fact, if you came in there with solution, No. We really could have been called Always in Collision with Something or Somebody Group. And you know what? You can always tell when a group is pretty sick. No offense, they usually don't grow. Right? Because anybody come in with solution, head on down the road. But if you're sick, come on in here. Come on. We want to talk about the mother-in-law, pain in the neck kids, how much you hate your job, and traffic. Mm-hmm. So those were our topics all the time. And so I mentioned in this meeting that I'm, Joe is really sick, and what are we going to do? And somebody said, you know what, Katie, you ought to go drive a school bus. School bus. She said, yeah, you have instant HMO, instant. And I thought, maybe that's God's will. I've got my fitness profession, you know, which allows me to work about 3 hours a day in my career. And I could go in the morning. You had to be there at 6 a.m. You drove the bus till 9. I could make it to my sick AA morning meeting. And then in the afternoon, I had to come back at 2 to 5. And then I'm still my whole fitness thing. This is clearly God's will. Now, I'm not saying it's not, but wait till you hear this deal. I go and apply for this bus job. Now, my best friend's husband's been killed in a car wreck. I'm trying to run her fitness business and my fitness business, and my husband's sick, and we're having major money problems. Major. We're very middle America. And his business, he's making mistake after mistake after mistake. I have absolutely no concern over this school district. I just want the job. Just give me the job. Let me get this, his brain looked at, and then I'm out of here. Because, see, when you live a life based on the abstinence of alcohol, I don't care about that school district. I don't care about insurance companies. I don't care about the IRS. Because they're too big. And if I can screw them, I'll screw them. That's what you do when you have no AA program, right? It's always okay to be a little dishonest. It's the IRS, for God's sakes. Come on. Who doesn't screw the IRS? Any terminology sounded familiar out there? Yeah. So, oh, yeah. So this is my life. And so I go in there. I get this bus job. Oh, my God. I have no idea. I got 20 hours I got to take of learning first aid, what to do if a pencil gets stuck in your eye. I haven't had a boss in 15 years. And all of a sudden now I got a boss. I'm not used to that. And I got a sense of entitlement that's unbelievable, guys. And so I get on this bus day one. Day one on this bus, and two middle schoolers behind me getting a fight, blood's everywhere. Well, you know what? I'm a scrapper. I mean, my nickname is Scrappy. And I get between those two boys. I grab them by the collar. I'm like, what the heck? I get them off that bus. We hadn't even left the school. And I'm walking these two boys to the principal. And these kids nowadays, man, there's a lot of hormones and everything out there. They're big, you know. And I'm walking these two boys. And this other bus driver goes, did you get the key? I'm like, no, I didn't get the key. Never even occurred to me. I run back, you know, I get the key, and I look at those kids, and I go, I swear to God, one of you kids steps out loud, I'll kill you. I'll kill you. I am in over my head, man, over my head. And, but that's Katie running the show. That's not unusual, right? So I got these two kids, man, I basically throw them in the principal's office because they're not getting back on my bus. You know, one blood's everywhere. Throw them in there. I come out, and I kid you not, those kids are jumping from one, middle school, jumping from one seat to another, and that entire bus is rocking like this. Man, and I am looking cute as a bus driver, I might add. I mean to tell you, I had the boots and the shorts and the T-shirt, you know, because not all bus drivers are that cute. And so I really added a little flair to the bus driver lot. But I get on that bus, and I mean, I am like, I swear to God, everyone, you guys, shut up, shut up. My son said, everyone thinks you're crazy, Mom. Good. Good. Because, I mean, I was nuts. And I am driving along, and what do you say when you're in complete self-will? All the time, I am in over my head again. Over my head. I bit off more than I can chew. That's just what I say. So, my husband's sick, and we realize he's not getting the doctor's thing. I'm 2 weeks into the bus. I'm like, God almighty, go get your brain scanned. And so I call his primary care physician, and he says, you know, Katie, just take him to the emergency room. And I thought, fine, get in the car. And we're not, you know, it's no emergency. So we get a cup of coffee on the way, and I'm prepping him because, you know, I'm running the show. And I said, okay, Joe, when we get down there, they're going to ask you to touch your nose, and I got to have you touch your elbow. They're gonna ask you to touch your knee, and I need you to touch your nose. You are to fail this test because we are not leaving out of there till your brain is scanned. Got it? Because I'm getting off this bus soon. I am in over my head. The octave level on a bus is deafening. And we get down there, and the doctor comes in. He goes, so you think you got some brain problems? I'm over there. You know me. I'm like, yes, he does. Yes, he does. Yeah, brain problems. Just scan that head. Go ahead. Show me where the machine is. I'll just shove him in there real quick. And he says, well, it, you know, and all the doctors all say to me, so where did you get your medical degree? It's like, that would be none of your beeswax, mister. And another statement I used to say in my head is, you know, you are not the boss of me. So I am sitting there, and Joe, the doctor says, sure enough, I don't know why I knew he'd say this. He says, Joe, I need you to touch your nose. And I swear to God, Joe goes like this. And he goes, I need you to touch your elbow. He's like, I'm going, oh, my God, you are blowing it. And so I'm thinking, well, plan B, how do I get his brain scanned? I'm going to knock the doctor out, you know, put on the white coat, run down there, kick him in the machine. And then the doctor says, you know, I need you to add 2 + 2, and he can't do it. And he asks him a couple more, count back from 5, and he can't do it. And he says, we're going to go ahead and scan your brain. And he takes Joe in there, and he comes back out, and I'll never forget, man. He laid his hand on my shoulder, and he says, oh, he's got a gigantic mass in his brain. He said, it's huge, big as a grapefruit. And I thought, I'm going to be driving that damn bus for the rest of my life. This is my first thought. I know that sounds terrible. It makes the Al-Anons gasp. But that's extreme example of self-will run riot. Though he usually doesn't think so. And so, now granted, I didn't say that out loud to my husband. But it was my first thought. Well, The other thing the doctor said was, he'll never work again. Oh, whoa. Oh, now you're hitting me on all kinds of fears. And from that point, I remember I couldn't even breathe, guys. We were middle America. I'm 15 years sober. What? My husband's got massive brain damage and he can't work? Oh, Jesus, this is tough. And so next thing I know, man, I start throwing it on my back. Throw it on my back. What do we need to do? And at that time, I had sold half my business about a year before, which, you know, where's God's will there? And I sold half my business. So I realized I had to make this living. And I'm in the fitness profession. And I swear to God, you need me to make money? I can go make money. Money I can make. And I ended up teaching a kids program, fitness. I taught a personal training program. I added 11 hours more a week to my schedule of teaching. And before you knew it, I was making $150,000 a year, but I was dying. And I'm driving that stupid-ass bus. God Almighty. You know, when your day starts at 6 and doesn't end till 8 and it's all given, 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 given. These kids needed me. Each class I had between 60 and 100 kids. I swear to God. My son goes, Mom, they all love you, but you're crazy. You're crazy. That's all right, honey. I'm crazy, but they love me. And so I am throwing all this stuff on my back. Remember, I'm taking care of my girlfriend's class because her husband died, blah, 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 blah. And everyone is in my vortex. That's all I need is everybody in my vortex. Oh, and I'm still traveling around the world speaking for my company. So I am, you know, trying to get all this stuff in there. And my husband is, he's had the brain surgery. And believe it or not, the tumor is benign. Oh, my gosh. When I look back and realize how many opportunities my husband had to live. But we were in what's called untreated alcoholism. I call it what it is. People call it a flat period. People call it dry. I call the disease the way it is. It was untreated alcoholism. I didn't even know where my big book was, nor did he. And we kind of fancied ourselves big book thumpers when we were in AA. You know, oh, I was running conferences. I was sponsoring. I was doing everything. I'd miss the entire self piece. How do you do that? I don't know. But I didn't. And so did he. And so we're tooling along, and the next thing I know, 6 years has gone by. I am so sick, guys. I am so ate up with the bedevilments. And my husband dies of a heroin overdose. He goes back out after 23 years sober. Dies of a heroin overdose. See, the bedevilments are available in sobriety. And I have to read them because this was my life. We were having trouble with our personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a, which means I couldn't enjoy making a living. I could make a living, but I hated it. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to anybody. That was my life. I had 3 anxiety attacks. Breathe in the bag anxiety attacks. See, when you don't have the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and you don't have booze, you got anxiety. You got depression. And most people turn to other issues. If you don't drink or kill yourself, you probably take pills. I'm not going to touch that one, trust me. But, and the doctor wanted me desperately on medication. Desperately. Oh, I'm very grateful I didn't, but I ended up hooking up with this sponsor. And this woman, little did I know, was coming out of untreated alcoholism also, but God dang it, she was just perfect for me. And Joe had been dead now for 18 months, and I'm absolutely out of my mind, and thank God for Charlie. He was my savior, because he loved me so much, and that's that love that Mildred's talking about. The people in Alcoholics Anonymous can carry you until you drink or kill yourself. They really can. And I can't tell you when you're going to drink or kill yourself, but they can carry you until you can hear God. And that's what Charlie did for me. He was my best friend. Man, it was like, I swear to God, it was like Lenny and Squiggy and Laverne and Shirley. You know, so don't get me wrong. It wasn't like Charlie and I were winking at each other when my husband wasn't looking. Can't wait to get together with you. It was like a brother. And so that's a whole other story how we had to cross that threshold, and it was very weird, wasn't it, honey? Yeah. Banging teeth when you kiss the first time. Is this really a... Oh, man. So, kind of like sleeping with your brother. But, so I meet Marty, and, Joe's been gone 18 months, and I say to Marty, I'm talking to her on the phone, I don't know where my big book is, I'm still going to that sick AA meeting, and I'm fancying myself a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I absolutely am a member of the fellowship, and that's it. And I said to Marty, I'm really struggling, man, I'm not doing well here. You know, Joe's gone, blah, 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 blah. And she said, you know, Katie, I want you to read page 60 to 63. And I thought, first of all, I'm going to have to find my book. Don't really know where my book is. I have an idea of where it is on the bookshelf. And she said, and I'm thinking, that's probably the part of the book that says some of us have tougher times in sobriety than others. And that, you know, especially if you've lost a loved one, you know. So I get my book out, and I kid you not, that's what I thought. I flip it open, and it just turns to page 62, where it says selfishness and self-centered that we think is the root of our trouble. And I don't like to cuss from the podium, but this story doesn't have effect unless I cuss. And I thought, oh, that bitch. Oh, my, did she not hear my pain? Oh, for God's. I remember sitting there walking around the house thinking, forget it. She is not my sponsor. She is not going to be blah, 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 blah. And when I finally called her back, I said, selfish and self-centeredness? That's the part you wanted me to read? And she said, you know, Katie, there's a fine line between sorrow and self-pity. And I believe you've gone into self-pity. You know, God had to put her in my life. She's the only one who could tell me that. Because otherwise, I got to blow you up. You don't get it. You don't get my pain. You're out of here. So you come against me and my ego, and I either got to listen to what you're saying, or I got to blow you up. And that's what I do. So this second surrender to the third step, I love it. I think it's Ron that states this. He says, when you come into Alcoholics Anonymous, you come off a fresh ass whipping from alcohol. No one's going to argue with that, right? But this second surrender to self, I come at self, I hit the wall, I back up, I hit the wall, I back up, I hit the wall hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times before I finally surrender. Because I don't even know what I'm surrendering to. I don't get it. I don't get the self piece. And so this is what I'd like to do, and I'm going to be as quick as possible, but I have to go through the book because it just works beautifully when I do that. It says, being convinced we were at step three. Now, that's in italics. It says we were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood Him. Didn't touch me. Don't get it. Will and life over to the care of God. Don't get it. It's too nebulous, right, honey? Is that the right big word I used? Nebulous. Okay. Yeah. I could have said it's too nympho-ish, but because I'm liable to do that at any time. And so if I get anything screwed up, just know you know what I meant. And so I can't wrap my brain around that. And Charlie was all worried. He goes, honey, just don't use a big word. You don't do it. It's going to screw you up. So just what do we mean by that? And just what do we do? There's your question. That statement, I don't get that statement, so the book's getting ready to explain it to me, right? So it says, the first requirement, what? The first requirement, that seems pretty important, is that I be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, which is always the underlying foundation, right, that we are almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though my motives are good. So I can't trust my motives. Well, I don't get life if I can't trust my motives. And you're telling me I'm always in collision with something or somebody, even though my motives are good. You betcha. Now, wait till I get into the rest of this definition, because it'll end up blowing you away. It says most people try to live by self-propulsion. It starts to talk about the actor. I don't know about you guys, but that whole actor thing didn't touch me. Range the lights and scenery. What? Well, what it's basically saying is, say I go to a movie set and I say, listen, I'd like to be in your movie. They go, perfect. You'd be a perfect stand-in. We want you to stand right there on the X Julia Roberts is going to walk past you, and you get to say to her, "That's a nice dress you have on." That's it. Got it? Oh, absolutely. I'm so excited. So I'm standing there, and I just can't wait, and the director puts the thing on, and all of a sudden, action. She starts walking in halfway. I go, Hold up just a second. I think you ought to be walking in from this side over here, and I'd be doing better off if I was standing back here. And you know what? That line is not really the best line for this movie. And if I could, I'd like to look at the title. The title could, we could tweak that title just a little bit. And that director goes, "Who is this person?" "It's Katie. You haven't met me yet. I'm running the show here. See, I know what's best for everyone. And I go through life like that. You get me anywhere close to 5 cash registers and only one's open and the line's out the back, I'm the one in there going, "We need more registers down front. More people work in the front down there." How many of y'all run the show everywhere you go? Yeah, you're at the bank. This is taking too long. Don't even go to the post office. Oh, they could care less how long you wait in that line. Get on the phone, right? You know how that is on the phone, and you explain the whole story to one person, they put you through to the other person gets on. "Hello, hey, yeah. So what's wrong?" "Well, I just explained it to so-and-so." "Well, I need you to explain it to me." "Not happy about that." I re-explain it to her. She'll hold on just a second, puts me on the phone. "You're going to make me explain this 3 times? Don't you know who I am?" Not doing it again. And then the issue's about me not explaining it again. I'm not going anywhere because I'm driven by self. I am always in collision with something or somebody. I start out nice on that phone conversation, but halfway into it, I'm liable to start cussing. I go to F you so fast it's terrible. Charlie is the diplomat in the family, so if you got an issue with me, you need to talk to him because I'll go to F you on line 3. I really will. It's like, I could care less what you think about me. F you. I'm out of here. And I'm not proud of that. Ed is right below the surface. Now I know it says we pause when agitated or doubtful, and most of the time I can, but the whole time you're talking to me, I'm thinking, F you, F you, F you, F you. Okay. And if you, I won't even go into the 3 things you gotta do to get me there, but they happen, and God and I are working on it. And so, it says, listen to this delusion. If Katie's arrangements would only stay put, if people would only do as Katie wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including Katie, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. See, I just want utopia for all of us. We call it Katie-topia. But that's all I want is happiness for all of us. And that is the delusion. That is where I think I can get this. So it talks about then the next paragraph down is the toolkit of self-will. And this is what I didn't get, right? It says in trying to make these arrangements, Katie may sometimes be quite kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. Oh my gosh, who wouldn't want to be that way? That sounds like a really nice person. And on the other hand, if I don't get what I want, man, I'm mean, egotistical, and selfish and dishonest. I can always tell when I got a motive. Now, I don't know I have a motive a lot of times, guys. Don't get me wrong. It's not like I wake up in the morning and rub my hands together and think of who I'm going to take advantage of or screw today, right? And I do not mean that in the literal sense. But you know what I'm talking about. It's that I'm trying to be kind, and when I don't get what I want, I'm going to have to blow you up. And that's when I get that I got a motive. Sometimes I know I do, sometimes I don't. What usually happens, the show doesn't come off very well. Katie begins to think life doesn't treat her right. How many of us are sitting there thinking life doesn't treat me right? It's not fair. It's not fair at all. She decides to exert herself more. She becomes on the next occasion still more demanding or gracious because I'm a chameleon. I walk in a room. I'm always working a room, guys. I mean, I walk in a room and I'm figuring it out. Who's who? Oh, there's so-and-so over there. Yuck. Okay, who's over here? Oh, I like them. Okay, I'm going there. I mean, I'm always working a room. If you get me around a table and it's a whole group of us, I am figuring out first and foremost where I'm sitting because I'm not sitting next to you. You're going to stick a tentacle in my neck and suck the life out of me. I ain't going to do it. Some other poor sap might sit next to you, but it ain't going to be me. You know, I mean, this is what we're working with up here. A mind that never stops. Now, granted, God has done amazing things with me, but until I get down to explain it to you the way this baby thinks, it's unbelievable. So it says, still the play doesn't suit her. She may admit she's somewhat at fault. She is sure more other people are more to blame. Now, I'll tell you, I think in AA, sometimes we miss the whole piece about people always saying, well, it's my part. The book never says my part. The book always says it's all yours, Katie. See, this line is so powerful because it says, admitting she may be somewhat at fault, she's more than others are to blame. If I have to take responsibility for just my part, it's always about this big. Your part's always about that big. So I'm kind of coming in there with a motive, aren't I? Hoping that I'm fishing well enough to get you to give me what I need. And so it says, and I love the way this comes in, it says, she becomes angry, indignant, and then self-pity. I can tell you this for AA, right? Your home group. I am angry at all of them, bunch of losers. Indignant for all I've done for that AA meeting. And the self-pity is something. Nobody understands the pain I'm in. I've dedicated my life to this group. Have I hit enough for y'all to get you on that one? Okay, good. Because I can't spend that much time in that area, but that's a good one, isn't it? So it says, what's the basic trouble? Is Katie really not a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? I love it. People always say, well, I'm a people pleaser. Wouldn't you be a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? And you know why I wanted to be a people pleaser? Because if you like me, I can take real advantage of you. It's so much easier to take advantage of somebody that likes you. Wouldn't you agree? Yeah. The person that doesn't like you got to really work so hard on getting their trust before you take advantage of them. So it's just easier. And so, once again, is she not a victim of the delusion? There's my line. And then it says, isn't it evident to the rest of the players what she wants? How many of y'all have ever had somebody walk up to you and you can tell they're totally self-seeking? And they're totally trying to get you to give them answers that they want. Right? It's evident to the rest of the players what you're trying to snatch out of life. And then it says, is Katie not even in her best moments a producer of confusion rather than harmony? My sponsor's always saying that. I'm standing around going, I was just trying to be helpful. Everybody's mad at me, man. What's that about? I didn't mean any harm. Gaw. Gee whiz. Oh, constant producer of confusion rather than harmony. And then it goes into the part of the book that I love. And that's the part that Marty loves to live in, my sponsor, selfishness and self-centered. That we think is the root of our trouble. It's where Mildred was saying, alcohol is but a symptom. It's driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Oh my gosh. So it's telling me right there, I'm driven, man. It says, drinking wasn't my problem. It was the only solution that calmed the beast. And that was the beast of Katie living on self-will. Remember my childhood? Driven. I was driven, man. And that booze was the only thing that took me away from that world. And I loved it till it quit working for me. So I clearly thought booze was my problem. See, guys, it's in my DNA to be self-centered. Now, to be awakened to that level of self-centeredness is a whole other ballgame. That's the beauty of what Sheldon's going to get into in the fourth step. It's going to be the beauty of what Larry's going to get into, what we're going to be doing in 6 and 7, Bill. It's you're getting ready to be awakened to this level of self because you have to see where it manifests. You have to. Only so you can take it to God, not so you can work on it. Self loves to work on self, right? So The key behind this level of selfishness and self-centeredness is I don't think too much of myself and I don't think too little of myself. I just think of me all the time. All the time. And that's the piece that we're talking about. So there is a couple of quick little stories that I got to tell you about this level of self-centeredness currently today that I'm aware of. We're doing a big book study, Charlie and I and Chris up in Canada. And when you do a big book study, you know, and you break for lunch, the people doing the big book study need to eat pretty quickly. But people like to come talk to you. And so I'm talking to these three guys and we're standing there and this girl has a sandwich and she comes up with that sandwich and she looks at the one of the guys, and they make eye contact, and she sets the sandwich down, and she walks away, and I say, a few minutes have gone by, and I thought, man, I better eat, because, you know, we're going to be getting started here pretty quick, and I look at the guy, and I go, did she bring you that sandwich? And he goes, no. I didn't know who she was, and I thought, oh. I'm one of the speakers. She clearly brought that sandwich for me. It never occurred to me that anything other than that. So I start eating a sandwich while I'm talking to these guys, and she walks up and she goes, what are you doing, man? Are you eating my sandwich? And I thought, oh, my God. It never occurred to me that was her food. See, inconsiderate means I never considered hers. I have a disease of perception, right? Then this one was my favorite. Any of you guys know that when you're a speaker, everyone knows who you are, right? You got the speaker ribbon. You got some sort of little protocol that we have to live by. I'm as self-centered as you are, trust me. And I'm on my best behavior, and I'm doing the best I can. I'm speaking in Oklahoma in front of 1,100 people. It's a big crowd. You know, these lines are very long, the receiving line. And the one beautiful thing about being a speaker is you get to sit on the front row, which means you get to beeline it over to them first. Have you all seen how we do that? We get to beeline it to the speaker that night and hug them first so we don't have to wait in that long line, because don't you know who I am? And, you know, I'm being of service, so just wait there in that long line is really what I'm thinking, at least. So I'm standing, and it usually makes a two-line deal, but this one line is always a short line, and the other one is the long receiving line, and the speakers kind of flow through there, and all of a sudden I'm beelining it over to the Friday night speaker, and this guy's standing in front of me, and I thought, well, I don't know how he got here. He's clearly not a speaker, but oh, well. And so, you know, he is not moving. And he's got like three opportunities to be making his move to thank the speaker. And so I realize, oh, who are you? And all of a sudden, I see he's got his fourth opportunity. So I just shove him. And I swear, he turns around, he looks at me, he's like, the heck? And I thought, go. For God's sake, the whole point of this short line is that we get through this procedure quickly. My speaker ribbon, mister. And I swear, I thought, I probably shouldn't have done that. That's welcome to my world, okay? That's me. Now, I'm going to keep going on. It says, driven by 100 forms of fear. Fear really isn't my problem, guys. God gave us the ability to have fear. He gave me the ability, if the house is on fire, for me to know to run. He gave me the ability, if I'm walking down a dark alley, it's a scary place, I better get down this alley quickly. It's self-centered fear is the root of my problem, right? It's me and what that does. I'm just driven by this fear. And here's a perfect example of it. When Joe died, he died 6 weeks before his 2-year probation on his life insurance policy. And I had taken out a life insurance policy because I dot the I's and cross the T, and I'm darn sure going to make sure I'm taken care of. Very expensive policy. But remember, it wasn't malignant. So he can get a policy because it was benign. And so we get this policy. And he dies 6 weeks before the policy is up, so they have to put it in probate, right? They got to check it out. If he'd have died in a car accident, it would have been the same thing. And so 6 weeks go by. I'm waking up with the four horsemen. I'm dripping in sweat. I'm in complete untreated alcoholism. I got to have this money. And I mean, you guys know that one where you wake up in the morning and the thought is right there, and you're just right. And all of a sudden, the guy says, they agree that they're going to send me the check. It took 6 weeks because it was very touch and go. And I get that check in my hand. Now, I'm still gripped with a pretty good amount of fear. I open that check. I open that envelope. I look at that check. It's a nice amount of money. And I instantly go into fear that I'm going to spend it all because I am bad with money, right? I am not responsible with cash. So I take the fear that I'm not going to get it, and I don't even get a breath. And it goes to the fear that I'm going to lose it. See, that's self-centered fear. I am deathly afraid of losing what I got and not getting what I think I need. Right? So I'm painted in a corner. That's what I live on. Is that level of self-centered fear. People call it abandonment. I'm afraid I'm going to be left alone. Of course. Who doesn't? That's not what it is. Let's get farther down. Let's get some work into what this self-centered fear looks like. I am afraid I'm not going to get what I think I need, and I'm going to lose it when I get it. That's self-centered fear for me, folks. And so what did I do? I spent that check in a whole year. I did. I spent it all. I'm still here today. But that's it. Now listen to this part. Delusion means that I read minds. I love Mildred touched on this very nicely. I read minds and I believe it's the truth, right? I believe a delusional lie when I look. Her example of looking through a straw was beautiful. My perspective of life is so narrow. If I held this book up and you didn't know it was a book, and I said, what do you see on the front? And you'd say, I see the triangle and the circle. And I'm looking at it from this way. And I go, no, there's no triangle on this. You're seeing something wrong. Now, I don't know it's a book. I don't know we're going to see this side of it, right? But the truth is I have a disease of perception. I have a delusional mind, not denial. Word denial is never used in our book. It's delusion. It means I believe something that ain't even happening. I believe it to be true. That's one of the reasons why when we sponsor women, we don't talk much about your feelings. Because it's a delusion, for God's sakes. It hadn't even happened. Last thing you want to do is go down the whole feelings road. You know what I mean? Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And then you boys, you don't get us that well, but I'm not going to touch on that. So, we live in a delusional mindset, yes? Now, I don't know this is a book. But what I'm going to teach you is to look at it from all different angles. That's what a good sponsorship does. Charlie has he had some health issues that were making me crazy, and it had to do with food. And so I see these pills sitting out, and I go, "Did you take some of these pills?" And he goes, "No, yes, I did this morning." I go, "Did you just lie to me? You just lied to me right there." And he goes, "Honey, I didn't want to worry you." Oh, my God. That is third on the list, folks. Yeah, even when trying to be kind, that is not why he did that. I'm on the list, and he doesn't want to worry me, but it's because of the top two things above that. He doesn't want to take responsibility for eating anything he wanted to for the last 3 days. He doesn't want to be held accountable, but it's because he didn't want to worry me. Doesn't that sound better? Oh, I know. I'm starting to lose people now. They're like, okay, go. Okay, a little too much on this third step. You're going a little too far, taking this deal way, not necessary. So here we go. It's a dishonesty, and it's believing the lie, yes? And that's what we do. One of the things my sponsor said is, she said, Katie, you think you know what Charlie's thinking? I said, oh, I know him. I know what he's thinking. And she goes, well, why don't you ask him? So one day I said, what are you thinking? Because I know what he's thinking. And he goes, I'm not even thinking. Now, ladies, that is shocking to us, yeah? Wow. So you're just sitting there thinking of nothing? I got nothing. It's just kind of a black screen. That was an awareness for me, you know, and everyone, one I didn't have. So then it says self-seeking. Now, this is an action part of this whole paragraph, right? Selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our trouble. Self-seeking is what I must do because self loves knowledge. Any of you guys know that you have a breakup or you lose a job, you got to talk to 20 people, right? You got to talk because you need some information. You need some help. Absolutely. And so self-seeking loves knowledge. It also comes out as gossip, comes out as sarcasm, making excuses. One of the things that is so amazing is what we tend to do on Facebook is a perfect one, this whole creeping thing, right? When you start snooping around in somebody else's page that you're not supposed to be there, all that stuff, looking on somebody else's phone. Yeah. Okay, so I got my guy here. So then it goes into self-pity, right? That is the part that is where I am the most pathetic. And that's the thing that I have to find, guys, that is the insane part. Because self-righteous and self-pity will make me absolutely crazy. Self-righteous, I can clean the house. Self-pity, I can't get out of bed. So it says, so our troubles are basically of our own making. That's a problem. I mean, a promise. If my problems are of my own making, then I'm the only one who can be free. I got to be the problem. And so it says, where did we set the ball rolling? Where did I step on the toes of my fellows? Where did I place myself in a position to be hurt? They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. There's another delusion behind all of that. That's the insanity. See, I can see self-centeredness in others, guys, but I am blinded to it in myself. That's why I have to have a sponsor. Then it goes into moral and philosophical convictions galore, right? I can't live up to them no matter how hard I try. See, when I drink, I'll sleep with your husband and I'll steal from you. But the truth of the matter is in sobriety, I can't be the greatest wife. I can't be the best mother. And I think, guys, when it talks about mere code of morals, that's where we've got to be careful, right? And it says, and Bob, I'm wrapping it up, I swear. Bob's got that strut going. Okay, so it says one of the things that we tend to do is we do do-overs in our home. A do-over is so important when we've got this level of self-centeredness going on. And once we've blown it, which we are capable of doing, then we end up having to do a do-over in our home. And I'm going to just flip through this because I only had an hour. I wanted an hour and a half, but I didn't get it. So we're going to flip into, I know. We're going to go into the terms, and then we're going to wrap it up. So it says in here, you know, the book says that God does not make too hard terms for those who seek him on page 46. Listen to these terms, okay? It says, we have to quit playing God. It didn't work, right? And it says, bear with me here. It says he was going to be the director, the principal, the father. I am going to be the agent, the child. Second part of the deal is when we sincerely took such a position, what position is that? That we were going to quit playing God? He provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. So you're telling me as long as I keep close to God and perform his work well, we're all done? I said, absolutely. See, guys, this is all about the things that are blocking us. I got to have God. He's got to watch my back, yeah? And then we have the fabulous prayer, which I won't go into reading because I think the promises are more powerful, and then I'll wrap it up. Lee, I thought we were doing really good on the time. Okay, well, sorry. The promises say, I will be less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. We became interested in seeing what life could contribute to, what we could contribute to life. We had peace of mind. See, that drink, guys, those first couple of drinks always gave us peace of mind. Almost every step says we're going to have peace of mind. We can face life successfully. We begin to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. We were reborn. Thank you very much. Thank you.